This is Karen Lyle with Sailsport Talk and a Sailing Science Spotlight. It's easy to see how a boat sails downwind. The wind pushes on a sail that's kept almost flat, and the boat zips along with the wind behind it. But how does a boat sail into the wind? The secret is air pressure. When a sail is angled into the wind, it curves. Some of the air streams along the inside of the sail, called the windward side, and some of the air streams along the curved outside of the sail, called the leeward side. The air traveling along the leeward side, remember that is the outside of the sail, has a longer way to go than the air on the windward side, the inside of the sail. So the wind on the leeward side has to go faster than the air on the windward side, and the air gets thinned out because it's going faster. When the air gets thinned out like that, the air pressure is higher on the inside, and that makes it a force that pushes the boat a little bit forward, but mostly sideways. If that were the whole story, a sailboat would keep slipping sideways and never get anywhere. But boats have rudders and either a keel or centerboard which extends straight down underneath the boat, and this makes it resist the slipping sideways. The result is that a boat is given a thrust by the wind that is more forward than sideways, kind of like when you push down on a watermelon seed and it shoots forward across the table. You can figure out how a sail works by putting your hand outside the window of a moving car. When you hold your palm open and flat to the wind, your hand will be forced back. This is how a sailboat moves forward when the wind is directly behind the boat and the sail is fully let out. Now, turn the side of your hand toward the front of the car and cup your fingers. As you try out different angles of approach to the wind, you will feel more or less pressure on the palm and back of your hand. That's how changes in the fullness of a sail can change the degree of forward motion created. But you can't sail directly into the wind. That is called the no-go zone, because you don't go anywhere. The sail works best on your typical sailboat when it is at an angle of 45 degrees or so. This is Karen Lyle with Sailsport Talk, and this has been a Sailing Science Spotlight, giving a shout-out to the Physics Department of the University of California at Berkeley.
A little Christopher Cross. You know what that means. That means it is time for Sail Sport Talk here on Titillating Sports, Sports Byline USA Broadcasting Network. This is Dominic Jimenez. And before I turn this thing over to Karen Lyle, I was talking with Karen during the break. Karen, you sailed over here from the East Bay?
Yes, I was the only sailboat out there on the bay today.
Respectfully, I'm not too surprised. I have like a 15-minute walk from Bart up Sansom here to the studios. It was cold, a little windy, but I will say it was clear. That had to make for better conditions that it was clear, right?
Well, there was a beautiful sunrise. So we left at 6 o'clock this morning from the Berkeley Marina, and then sailed on by Treasure Island. And just about the time as we were passing Treasure Island, you could see the sun coming up, and it was a beautiful sunrise. And the sun just comes and lights the buildings in San Francisco, and you can just see a few of the taller ones, and then the ones that have mirrors usually pick up the sunlight really beautifully.
I have a general idea of how long it takes to get to the East Bay from San Francisco driving. How long does it take by sailboat?
Well, let me see. I think it was about an hour to an hour and a half, somewhere in there. I think we got in a little bit after 8. And so we probably left the dock about 6:30. So I'd say an hour and a half. Now, this is not speed sailboat. This is a 36-foot Hunter Vision that's a freestanding rig. And actually, there was no wind this morning. That's probably another reason why there were no sailboats. We'll probably sail back. But that early in the morning, sometimes in the winter, the winds are pretty light.
Does it take a while to really get going when there's minimal wind like that?
Well, you know, a boat has something called a hull speed, and the hull speed is how fast the boat moves through water. And whether the boat is being powered by the wind or by a motor, it has a limit. And our hull speed is about 7 knots, so that's a little bit slower than those SailGP boats that just broke the 50-knot barrier.
Just a smidge. And for the people who have not been with this Sail Sport Talk long, approximately knots to miles per hour. What is the approximate translation, the conversion? Do you know?
You know, that I'm going to ask my captain who's here. 1.15. So my captain, Michael Arntz, is here in the studio with me observing, and he tells me it's 1.15.
Okay, so it's almost the same.
Yes,
I got
pretty
you.
Close.
Karen, thank you for indulging me in a few sailing questions I had, because I saw you bundled up, and I had forgotten you sailed over. I'm like, I know it's cold, but it's not that cold, Karen. Are you doing okay? I forgot you sailed on. I think you got a guest. Is that correct?
I do.
Okay, I'll let you take over. I'm turning my microphone off. Karen Lyle, Salesport Talk. Let's do this.
Thank you. And so this is Karen Lyle, and I have with me Chris Weikert, who is a fellow journalist and actually someone who's been a veteran in journalism for a very long time, most recently the last 40 years with CBS. And she is also the niece of Kay Rooney, who played the organ for the Admiral Nimitz Officers Club. And that was in the 1950s. And when I was sailing over from Berkeley, I passed Treasure Island, but that officers' club is no longer there.
Yeah, changeover when the club, the island was decommissioned, but the club in its day was a thriving, vibrant place in the 1950s and the 1960s and into the 1970s.
So, just the very first part of your words were missed. It was taken over and razed, so it's no longer there. And really a happening place in the 1950s and 60s. And that's where all of the officers came from who were both retired and active in the U.S. Navy.
Yes, Admiral Nimitz among them. It was a place after World War II where people either retired here, base was still active, they lived there. And as such, there was a club for them to go with the dining room, which was, probably sat about 400 people. It had a band on some nights, and then my aunt was there three nights a week playing the organ in the dining room.
Well, and you know, one of the reasons why I invited you on the show was not just because you're a fellow journalist, and I love to have fellow journalists come and visit with me here, but also because you had some Christmas music that she did. That you gave me a few little snippets of, and I'd actually like to play maybe 30 seconds of one of those songs. If we can go into that, why don't you go ahead and take it away? We're going to listen to 30 seconds. Great old Hammond B3 organ.
That's correct. That was recorded in about 1991 in San Rafael in my aunt's living room, where the organ went after it left Treasure Island. Part of the job of being a professional musician and an organist was you have to bring your own instrument. So she did. She moved that over to Treasure Island, and as I say, it lived in the dining room there for all of those years. Previous to that, she had taken it to the Philippines, where her husband was a major in the army over there, and so it went to the Philippines. He was killed over there, not in combat, but frankly in an automobile accident. And she came back with the organ to San Francisco and then left aboard the President Cleveland line to be the organist in the dining room there. And then she came back to San Francisco, played at the Palace Hotel, and then in about 1951, got the job at Treasure Island, where she was there until her retirement.
This is Karen Lyle with Salesport Talk, and we're in the studio talking with Chris Weikert, who is a CBS broadcasting journalist and also the niece of Kay Rooney, who played the organ at the Admiral Nimitz Officers Club on Treasure Island. And we're talking about Treasure Island today because it is actually a sailing destination here in the Bay that is oftentimes not thought of so much because it used to be a military base, and that wasn't a place that a lot of people could go and land unless they were involved with the Navy or something to do with the military. There's always been the, we have the Treasure Island Yacht Club that's located there. And when that became decommissioned, there's new plans now for development on the island, and there's going to be lots of building, and the Treasure Island Museum is one of the beneficiaries of that.
Right, and the Treasure Island Museum, when I was looking for a good home for the instrument, I contacted them, and this year they acquired it. This is after a complete renovation of my aunt's organ, and it is now owned by them. It's in their museum, which is a delightful place with memorabilia, not only from the Navy's time at the island, but from the World's Fair there, the exposition, and so forth. So it just seemed like a fitting place for it. And I know they're going to be having concerts. They've already had one this holiday season. But the music you heard just now in the little clip was typical of the kind of music that was played in the officers' club there. I mean, it was sort of uptight. It'd try a little Tenderloose, you know, themes from various Broadway shows, and that's what they wanted to hear in the club there. Mame was one of my aunt's favorites.
Sing along a little bit,
and feel very, very good there.
So let's talk a little bit about your background as a journalist and some of the things that you've done. You've given me a little bit of history. Could you share with us your background?
Well, just briefly, I had the good fortune to work on the student paper at Berkeley in the late 1960s and into the early 70s. And so I did that. While on the campus there, I was a stringer for United Press International and the San Francisco Examiner. That means that you were kind of the campus correspondent for those sort of places. And then after Berkeley, I went to New York for a year to Columbia Journalism School, came back and really kind of expecting to work on a newspaper, and sort of stumbled my way into broadcasting, working as a part-time person on the assignment desk at KTVU, and then had the good fortune to be hired full-time at KQED on their newsroom show, which was really an acclaimed broadcasting show that was on starting in the 1966, and then it went off the air, I think, in the 1980s. And that program was really very, very defining for me. I would leave there with a group of KQED people, went to KPIX, where I was the assignment editor in the mid-1970s. And then I went back to public broadcasting and ran a news and public affairs system for the California public broadcasting stations. And that, too, was in the 1970s. In 1979, I was recruited by CBS News and have worked for them ever since.
Well, now that's a different experience working for a PBS station affiliate like KQED and working for a commercial network like CBS. What do you notice are some of the differences between the two?
Well, there was the funding part. I mean, they just had the resources. And, of course, working national versus local, because I work for a national news organization, it's a whole other way of approaching the stories. So, for example, you know, there are certain stories here which are very, very important to San Francisco Bay Area, but are not necessarily going to be relevant to somebody who lives in Tallahassee, Florida. So our mindset when we work for national is, well, how does it affect, you know, an entire country? And, of course, now with what we do at CBS, I mean, we have a reach worldwide. So,
well, now also with the Internet.
Streaming, and
that,
yes.
that application really, and that's the same thing that we have to take into consideration here on Sports Byline and also Salesport Talk, is that we're originating from San Francisco. However, we are broadcasting to 168 countries and 82 million people, which is about 700 radio stations and XM Sirius Radio, iHeart Radio, TuneIn, Stitcher, and the American Forces Network. So there's a lot of reach there. And so finding the relevance, oftentimes I think also when Rick is usually co-hosting this show with me, and he's off today, but he has a long relationship with the American Forces Network and our servicemen and women out there. And so that little bit of of history about the Admiral Nimitz Club and Treasure Island is actually going to be important to someone out there who's listening to this show today.
Well, I think that's what happened with me with the organ. As I, you know, I said, well, what is the, you know, where is the relevance for this going forward? It certainly wasn't, as it turned out, being in my dining room. Anymore. Nobody in my family played it. I checked with my cousins, and we all, you know, kind of agreed that it should, you know, go someplace that would have a purpose going forward. And matching it, of course, with a place where my aunt had a long history and a following there as well, was just perfect. And so I guess in a way, I don't have to think about this, but I guess in a way, it's sort of my nose for news, my journalism background said, okay, how can we do this? And I was fortunate that they accepted the gift as well. I should add that we had it completely renovated before it went there. So it's like brand new.
Well, I have a piano rebuilding business, and I think the Hammond B organ is the only organ that I've ever really gotten involved with because it's such a classic, and there's a sound that's very characteristic. But I want to ask you a little bit about on the journalism side. Today, if you're looking at journalism when you started and journalism today, how would you say that the changes have affected you as a journalist in how you approach a story?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know that it really has. We are doing stories in a shorter amount of time, not just the production part, but what the amount of time on the air. But that is because the demand is for shorter stories. But I don't think that changes at all how I approach the story. When I approach, this is my print background, I think editorial first and sort of television second. And so, you know, I'm curious, just as you know, is what makes us tick as journalists. And so I just can't get enough information first about the story, and then I visualize how to present this in a way that is, you know, comfortable for people. So I don't know that my news instincts have changed because the way things have changed.
So we're speaking here with Chris Weikert, the niece of Kay Rooney, and we're listening to the organ in the background. And this is Karen Lyle with Sail Sport Talk. So glad to be with you here today on Christmas Eve. Thank you so much, Chris, for being on the show.
Delighted.